Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Author Brad Ricker joins us today. It's the second time he's been on Conversations Live, and I'm pleased to have him back with his brand new nonfiction book. It's called True Raiders, The Untold Story of the 1909 Expedition to Find the Legendary Ark of the Covenant. So I think the title says it all. It gives you a good idea of what the story's about. And I'm not going to give away the events of this story, but suffice to say, it's full of adventure, twists and turns, and almost unbelievable real-life situations and characters. When Brad learned that his favorite movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, might have been inspired by a true expedition, that's all it took to send him searching for more information, and that ultimately led to this new book. So let me tell you a little bit about Brad. Lots to talk about. He is the author of the Edgar-nominated Mrs. Sherlock Holmes, Olive the Lionheart, which is also a podcast on our website, Olive the Lionheart, and Superboys, winner of the Ohiana Book Award for Nonfiction. He won the St. Lawrence Book Award for American Masterdom. And here's my guest, Brad Ricker, his book again, True Raiders, The Untold Story of the 1909 Expedition to Find the Legendary Ark of the Covenant. Brad Ricker, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Vicki. So good to talk to you again.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. And it's been a little while, so it's good to have you back with your new book. You know, I can't remember where I read it, but I thought it might have been on Twitter when somebody said something to you like, don't you ever write about normal things? How do you find these stories? So let's let's begin right there.
Oh, that's such a great question. I don't know. Normal is just kind of too normal. I like stories where, I mean, my kind of litmus taste test is where I'm reading about it or hearing about it, and that kind of sense goes off that there's no way this is true. And then, of course, it always almost is. And I love those stories that defy explanation, easy explanation, and kind of push the limits of what we're willing to accept, because I think there's, and I think that falls into what's normal and maybe what's not normal. But I like stories that are interesting. I like stories that are really challenging in terms of thinking about what's true and what's not, and really kind of upsetting that balance a little bit.
Definitely. And this book is called True Raiders, The Untold Story of the 1909 Expedition to Find the Legendary Ark of the Covenant. So I read, you said when I first learned that Raiders of the Lost Ark, my favorite movie, might have been based on an actual archaeological expedition, I felt like my face was melting off. So tell us a little bit about your obsession with the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I read that you brought all this wonderful stuff for yourself one Christmas, or maybe they were Christmas gifts. How that obsession started for you?
Yeah, so I think everyone has that one movie that really gets you when you're a kid, unless you don't see movies or that kind of thing, but that really sinks its claws into you. And then even when you grow up and you see much better movies and much more sophisticated cinematic experiences that move you, there's still that one movie that no matter what, you just love, and whether you admit it to others or just to yourself. And to me, it's Raiders. And I saw it as a kid. I went to the theater with my dad and my little brother. And that was just it for me. And I think it was even more so than Star Wars. I mean, just the obvious, the adventure and the action. But there was that element of reality to it, that it took place in a distinct historical time period. It took place in our universe. The Nazis were the bad guys, and the only thing that was kind of on the edge of all that was the Ark. And this is this thing that, you know, it's in the Bible and it's been written about, but has been lost for centuries, becomes this ultimate object of mystery. You know, was it real? Was it not? What did it do? Could it have possibly had all these powers that it does in the movie? And that just never got rid of me. And I loved it, too, that, you know, Indy's not only running around with the whip and the hat, but he's also a professor, and he's doing research, and he has the tweed jacket. And I just really liked that. And I said, that's, you know, I was pretty young, but I said, that's the kind of lifestyle that I want to have when I grow up. And it didn't, you know, it's not 100% happen that way, but a little bit, which is, I think, is kind of, sometimes I think it's really cool, and sometimes I think it might really be quite sad, but that's the way it is.
Well, you certainly got to do a lot of research on this story, so I'm curious about, okay, you hear this story about the Parker expedition, which the book is based on, and you write the notion that in 1909 a rogue English nobleman signed on with a shadowy syndicate to hunt the Ark of the Covenant sounds ludicrous, but it happened. And they all say truth is stranger than fiction, right? But what made you want to take this a step further and start researching and eventually write a book about it?
Yeah, that's a terrific question when you pose that, because that old cliche, you know, truth is stranger than fiction, it's true. And because there's that but in the middle of it that you so rightly pointed out, because regardless of what I think of it or what anyone thinks of it, this expedition happened. It happened, 100 years ago, and so it's just kind of up to us to look back and see, well, how did it happen? Why did it happen? Because like you, I think that if someone, you know, came up to us today and said, well, I've found the Ark of the Covenant, let's raise a lot of money and go dig in Jerusalem illegally, that's not something I think that most people would just jump to, you know, change their lives to do. And yet these guys did it. And that just fascinated me. Even more so than the Ark itself, because, you know, how do you have that kind of, and this wasn't really that long ago, how do you have that kind of, where's the faith in that? I mean, is it faith in the Ark? Is it faith in making money? Or just that adventure, that sense of adventure that someone says, hey, I've got this great caper lined up, let's go. And that just fascinates me to know it.
Yeah. So let's look at a couple of the characters if we can. And you do list these at the front of the book, which I like as a reader myself, because I like to know who I'm dealing with and what they're about. But the first one to come into the book is Sir Charles Warren, a servant of the British Empire. Tell us a little bit about him and why he was significant to this story. What made him an interesting character?
Yeah, so there's a lot of, as you say, there's a lot of characters in the book, and I thought that, you know, the only way I can really tell a true story about the Ark of the Covenant, which is something which no one knows is real or not, is to kind of let these people tell their own story. And luckily for me, many of them wrote down their experiences. So Charles Warren, though, the main storyline in the book is of the Parker expedition. Warren was one of the first Brits to kind of go to Jerusalem and start hunting around as an archaeologist, looking for these biblical artifacts. And he is the first to go through these tunnels that the Parker expedition later does. And he really finds a lot of mystery when he goes there. He doesn't know what he's looking for. And so it kind of sets up a really kind of strangeness to it that we see him going through these tunnels decades before the Parker expedition does. And the questions that he has, they kind of find answers to. And they're not talking to each other, but they're using kind of the Parker expedition is using some of Warren's maps, and it kind of makes it a larger really secret and mysterious and just, you know, brimming with all these stories.
Yeah. And I have to say, when I started reading the book, chapter one, I mean, it reads like fiction. And you instantly, you could get instantly drawn into it and want to carry on. You know instantly this story is going to be a great adventure. So great job in the writing of this.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to read stories where you can actually feel that you're there. So let's talk a little bit about Monty Parker. And I have to tell you, if I say Monty Python, you're going to have to excuse me, because a couple of times when I was reading the book, I read Monty Python in there, because, of course, they did a movie, The Holy Grail, right?
Oh, yeah.
So let's learn a little bit about Monty Parker and, you know, who he was, what challenged him. There was a specific challenge that drove him to seek the Ark.
Yeah, so he's the one that there's this syndicate. They're the, you know, they have this big name. You can't make that up. But they're the money, and they get the thing going. And they choose Monty as their leader. And he's kind of a nobleman. He's the second son of an earl. So he doesn't inherit the title or the big palatial estate. So he's kind of in limbo. In terms of money and society, he's a soldier actually, and he's come back because he's been injured and kind of looking for something to do. And I think one of the main reasons he goes is just money. Is once the group starts and they hear that the Ark could be there, they're not motivated by spiritual concern. They know that if they find it, they are going to be ripped beyond their wildest dreams, and that motivates them. And I think that changes over the course of the book, but that's what starts it. But there's this great story too that he is involved with Ava Astor, who is the who has just divorced from the very rich Astor family of America, and she's made her way to London. And the newspapers call her the most beautiful woman in the world. She's also incredibly wealthy, and there's just all of these just lines of Englishmen just, you know, waiting to make her acquaintance. And the papers write that she's interested in Monty, and they're seen at all these parties and at a horse race. And there's this story that she kind of dumps him. She's interested in this other guy with more money, more prestige. And as she's kind of, you know, telling him this, he says, well, I'm not going to be around for a while because I'm going to go to Jerusalem to find the Ark of the Covenant. And to me, this is like the greatest line you could ever give to someone who is in the middle of dumping you. Because there's really no response to that.
It's no response.
Kind of pauses, but because she's so great and she's so sharp, she says, well, if you find it, you know, give me a call when you get back. I think that's part of it, too. What motivates them is money and prestige, but also just another, you know, on the long list of kind of dumb things that people do for love.
Right, right. And another thing that sounds totally crazy is that the expedition was guided by this mysterious Finnish scholar using a secret cipher that he found in the Bible. So tell us about him and how he came into the story.
Yeah, and you know, when I hear somebody else say it, it just seems like, you know, enough with this story, but I promise you it's all true. Yeah, there's this biblical scholar from Finland who kind of starts the whole thing off. His name is Walter Juvelius, is his great name. And he's a surveyor, and he's kind of lost a little bit in life. He starts reading the Bible, and he is just entranced by it. He starts reading it in ancient Hebrew and learning it. And he is absolutely positive that he has found a secret code in the Bible. And secret codes were kind of a big thing back then. I mean, I think they still are now, but, you know, people were claiming to finding codes in Shakespeare and certainly the Bible. And Juvelius says his was in the book of Ezekiel. And it was an elaborate code of every seventh letter, and you'd pull it down, and they would start making sentences. And it led him, he said, to where the Ark was buried, underneath these secret tunnels of Jerusalem. And, it sounds ludicrous, but he brings it to the syndicate, and they start seeing these sentences appear from Ezekiel, like, walk 40 steps down the tunnel, turn right, and behold the fire of God. And they're seeing it like this, and it becomes very persuasive to them, so much so that they say, okay, we're going to raise money and get a group together and go find the Ark.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, to put things in perspective, the Parker Expedition in 1909, right? And you point out on your website that at that same time, their adventure crisscrossed into other infamous historical stories, such as King Tut's curse, the Titanic, and, of course, Jack the Ripper. And, you know, we didn't have the internet back then, obviously. Travel was a lot more difficult. So there probably was a lot more sense of adventure around things like this, too.
Mm. Yeah, it. When I started to write this, I knew, you know, when you write about, again, the Ark of the Covenant, it's not like you're writing about the Liberty Bell. You know, something you can go and tie. Well, if you touch it, you'd probably get arrested, but you have something physical around you, that the Ark is so mysterious that I wanted to evoke that same kind of mystery about it that the movie certainly has. And all this, when Raiders came out in the 80s, there was all this kind of sense of UFOs, of Bigfoot, of kind of today what we call conspiracy theory, but it was a little, I think it was a little less dangerous. I think it was a little more fun, maybe more adventurous, and that's what I kind of wanted to evoke in the book. So I told myself, if any of these other kind of things show up, I'm just going to follow them along. And sure enough, like you said, there's the Titanic. There's King Tut's curse is in this book, which is I couldn't believe that was related. And once I found the strand that led to Jack the Ripper, I couldn't turn it down. And I'm not a big fan of Jack the Ripper. I mean, not a fan, but, you know, like all these people that research it.
Right.
But I knew I had to go into it, and it's you know, as they say, it's either all connected or it's not connected at all. So I leave the reader to decide.
Well, I want to talk a little about that, because I want to look at some of the research, and let's go straight there, since you just brought it up. But, you know, in history, a lot of things are debatable, and they're based on many sources, and historians will eventually take the most credible sources and, you know, come to the assumption that this probably happened based on this whatever had the most credible sources. So what kind of stories did you come across there that you maybe could have put in the book and left out?
I decided, that's a terrific question too, because you do have to make those choices in a book, in a project, or anything where you're kind of weighing, you know, what's believable and what's not believable. With this book, though, I it was still the art kind of limited me a lot, but it also freed me up to kind of let all that kind of storytelling in. So I put in everybody that was involved in the story. I let them tell their version of it, even though some of them, I think, are really unreliable and really not believable. But I kind of say that, and I give hints to that, but I wanted the reader to kind of look at all the different versions of the story and kind of decide for themselves what's the most credible, and also what one do I believe. Because there's a big difference here, because you can look at, like, the history of the Ark itself, say, oh, this was definitely a real thing, or say, oh, no, it was a metaphor. And that's very different than, you know, asking someone, do you believe that something like the Ark existed or that it still exists today? So I wanted to have that separation between truth and belief because I wanted readers to think about it. So I definitely opened the floodgates for this book. And like I said, there's a couple people in there who I think are pretty unreliable, but they were insistent that their version was truthful when they told it. So I decided to, you know, let them tell their story and see what the reader thinks.
Right, the truth. The truth, you know, the truth as we see it can often be very different, right? You write in your very extensive notes that you went through a series of incomplete sources. You spread it over time, which you kind of just covered, including letters, reports, books, mathematical code, scriptures, hand-drawn maps, legends, conspiracy theories, scientific data. I mean, the list is long. How long did it take you to research the story? And did you, when you set out, did you have a thesis in mind for this, or did you just gather your research?
Yeah, I just, in the beginning, I just really liked the story. I couldn't believe it was true. And I kept kind of chipping at it for years, really. And I couldn't find any, because I knew to tell it I would need one really credible source to kind of anchor the whole thing. Because I think it's fine to, like, have people tell their, like, fish stories, but you really need the big one or two at least. And I just couldn't find it. I kept writing the current Earl, and I had to look up, you know, how do you write a letter to an Earl? How do you address it? And, you know, it's my dear Lord so-and-so. And I was very pleased with myself. I kept writing these letters, but they would never come back. So I had no idea how I would do it, but I knew I needed facts. So finally I was able to get a few things that were definitely facts. And I said, once I have, like, that kind of skeleton, I could bring the others in too. And I realized that, you know, I couldn't rely just on, you know, just on one source, because this is a matter of belief. You know, you have to hear different people. But yeah, it wasn't until I found the records of the actual expedition, which were hinted at that they existed, but I couldn't find them. And finally got a hold of them. That really gave me you know, official reports and things like ledgers and invoices and the cipher itself. So that really gave me, I think, the kind of green light to say, okay, you've got this. Now you can, you know, see if you can write a book about it.
Right. I love that you included photographs in the book. I always think it's really cool to look at the people that you're talking about. How challenging was it to grab those photos?
There's a few floating around. So Monty was a big photographer, but his photos from the expedition haven't really been found or haven't really been shared. I think it's one of those two. And those would be really interesting to find. But I had a couple from him. One of the real good sources was one of my favorite characters in the book is a priest, and his name is Father Vincent. And so when the Parker expedition goes, they're all ex-soldiers and psychics, and they have no archaeologists. And they quickly find out that, you know, they have no idea what they're doing. So they bring on this priest who's in Jerusalem. And he's also, you know, he's a priest, but on the side, he has this, you know, real interest in archaeology, and he's really great at it. And they don't tell him what they're looking for, but he goes in and he measures everything, and he does this great work on it. He's just a fascinating person. But he took photos, and his friends in his order took photos, and they're still, you know, there in their little archive in their little church in Jerusalem. And I sent them an email. And I said, hey, can I use some of these photos, see the photos, and, you know, how much do you charge? What about the rights? And, you know, there's this whole thing you have to do. Mm. And they were great. They're like, use whatever you want. You know, just if you could, you know, just put our name on it, that'd be great, and thank you. And they were so nice, and they had these great photos, so
right.
I'm glad you liked them.
Yeah, they were great. Especially, I like the one of Sir Charles Warren for some reason. He just looked like an explorer. He looked like an Indiana Jones character. So, being a fan of Spielberg's movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, what in your research delighted you the most, Brad?
Oh, that's a good question, too. Just that, you know, I think I started out filled with optimism and, you know, I'd be lying if there wasn't, like, a small part of me that said, well, what if I, you know, found the Ark? If they found, you know, in some part of the reports, and I knew I wouldn't do that, but... And then you get a sense of kind of, oh, no, because I knew that it couldn't be as good as Raiders of the Lost Ark. But then I thought, as more I researched and more I read and started to write, that this was its own story. But it did have parts of it that the movie used or had to have used. I mean, there's names that are the same. There's situations that happen that are right in the movie. But the part that really, I'm kind of dodging your question a little bit. The part that I guess, was amazed, your word?
Delighted. Amazed is good, too.
Delighted.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, it's just that, to me, it's, you know, they broke all kinds of laws to do this. And I think there's two answers to the question. I'm delighted that they did it. That I can't imagine, you know, in today's world, just going off on an adventure like that. And I think there's a real danger to believing in stories too much, conspiracy stories. But I think there's stories that connect to everything, where everything makes sense. But I think there's also something we've lost a little bit by not believing in stories as much as these guys did.
Hmm.
And the other thing that really gets me is that I was so happy that they didn't end up, I think for the most part, at the end where they were in the beginning, that they weren't just looking for money, they weren't just looking for glory, that they had become part of this grand story of the Ark of the Covenant and that it affected them.
Right, right. Tell us about the friend, in quotes.
Yeah, so there's the end... The end of the book, I mean, you know, it's not like it's kind of like the Titanic. You kind of know they're not going to find the Ark. I don't think I'm giving anything away, but they do find something, and I won't give that away.
No,
but the end is this, like, terrific, like, heist action piece where it's right out of Raiders the movie, where Monty kind of thinks he knows where it is. He thinks it's underneath the Dome of the Rock, which is one of the most holiest places in Jerusalem, and you know, you are not allowed to dig there. So he puts himself in disguise and his men in disguise, and they go up and they bribe the guard, and they start digging in the Well of Souls, it's called, and that's what's called in the movie too. And what happens is, days later, on the plastered across the headlines of newspapers all over the world is, have Englishmen found the Ark? Have thieves found the treasures of Solomon? And there's riots in Jerusalem when they find out that people were digging. And they get away, but then there's all this sort of mystery and conjecture as to what happened. And I found this person who wrote into a paper, he's just called The Friend, and he knows all this information about the expedition, more so than even the report. And I double and triple checked, and everything was factual. So it's kind of like they either had someone on the inside who had turned against them, a spy, or someone for a rival who was also looking for the Ark, or someone who had just had enough. So it's kind of a mystery at the end, and I think the audience, the reader, can figure out on their own what exactly happened.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I'm not sure.
Yeah. And so, you know, writers often talk about their writing process, but I'm really interested in the research process as far as how you keep track of all this when you're going through this, because I think you had like 30 pages of notes, if I'm remembering correctly, but it was a lot. It was a lot.
Yeah, I think that with especially, I mean, I wish I had like could tell you I was like really perfectly organized, but I'm a colossal mess when I write something. It's not organized at all. But the notes help me organize things. And I was an English major, so the notes, you know, that's why I do the notes. But to me, especially with this book, the notes were really important because at times the narrative on this book is really out there. And the notes are what can bring it back to earth and can be the place where the reader says, okay, I believe this, I believe this person, or maybe I don't. You know, all this stuff happened in the book, but the notes are where they can get a sense of what the source of it is.
Mm. And I have to let you go soon, but one quick question here that I really want to get at is how you climb into these characters' heads when you're writing.
Yeah, I was so happy they were so different because that lets me do it. The thing that I couldn't figure out how to write this book until I was looking over my shelf and I saw a William Faulkner book. And I'm not even like a huge William Faulkner fan, but there's this one book, As I Lay Dying, where he has all these different narrators and it alternates. And I said, that's how I can do it. And like I said, luckily these people wrote. They wrote books, they wrote news articles, they wrote diaries, so I kept reading and reading them, you know, to get a sense of their voice and just tried to, you know, replicate that as much as I could.
Mm. Well, the book is a really fascinating read. It's called True Raiders, the Untold Story of the 1909 Expedition to Find the Legendary Ark of the Covenant. And I know listeners can find out much more about you at trueraiders.com, more about this book. A final thought you'd like to leave listeners with today, Brad?
I don't know, a final thought. That's so, it seems very final. to be safe and have a happy holiday.
All right, that's a good one. That's a good one. All right, well, thank you so much for being with us, Brad Ricker. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Vicki. It's a true pleasure.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.